Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
We're talking about self-reliance, intentional communities, and we were looking at this self-reliance summit for some ideas because these people are all finding it very interesting to be self-reliant, and they have a lot of different ideas. Some of them are looking at history, some of them are looking at nature, some of them are looking at government, some of them are And they're doing this in an overlapping fashion because, you know, like even just to be concerned with, the presence of honeybees in society and in the world. Honeybees are essential for the success of crops, and crops are essential for the success of people. And there are practices going on in society today that seem to be affecting the existence of bees, and millions upon millions upon millions of bees have died in where the hives, you know, stopped thriving. They literally just died out. So why is this happening? Why are these different society elements of society telling us? Is this like the canary in the mine shaft? People used to take canary down in the mine shafts, and if the canary dropped dead, because the canary was very sensitive, if the canary dropped dead, then you knew that there was like poison gas in the mine, that maybe it was carbon dioxide was becoming too prevalent in the mine, and you were going to die yourself, and you knew you had to get out of there because the canary would die before you did because it was more sensitive. So these other elements in society or in nature, such as bees, if bees die out, we die out. I mean, even Albert Einstein saw that, because bees are so essential for the success of crops, because many crops rely on bees to pollinate them. And because of changes in society concerning banking, money, you know, what we see posing as money, it has become absolutely essential that if you produce a surplus, you need to sell that surplus right away, because everybody's operating in debt. So they have to sell that surplus so that they can pay their debt, because the interest will grow faster. I saw many ranchers go out of business or go tremendously into debt during a period of time where suddenly they had made a habit of borrowing their operating expenses every year. At the beginning of the year, they'd get a line of credit, $60,000. And they, if they needed money, they would just borrow against that line of credit, and the bank would start charging them interest. And then when they got to the point of selling their calves, they would pay off the loan. So every year they would have this operating expense loan. Well, all of a sudden, the interest rates jumped up to double digits. Well, the cows that they were raising wouldn't gain weight fast enough to pay a double-digit interest rate. And so they found themselves going farther into the hole. And there wasn't anything they could do about it because they had become addicted to borrowing their operating expenses. If they had simply tightened their belt for a year or two, they could have saved up what their operating expenses were, put that in the bank, and loaned themselves the money and saved that interest. But because of other changes in society, such as tax laws, it was to their advantage to borrow. You know, when they buy a truck, instead of just buying the truck outright, it was to their advantage to borrow money to buy the truck, because the interest that they paid to the bank was deductible. So there was this built-in thing into the economy by the changing of laws that led the people to go to the bank and borrow money. we're borrowing money to do things is a violation of the Sabbath commandments in the Bible. Now, most people don't make that connection, but it's very clear that in order to rest on the seventh day, you had to first work on the 6 days and then take your rest. When you're borrowing money, you're taking your rest. You're taking the benefit of the next 7 days of work or 7 years or maybe 70 years, depending on the size of the loan. You're borrowing against the future. You're taking the profit today in the form of borrowing money and at interest against, you know, so you're taking that against what you will pay tomorrow, the labor that you will pay out tomorrow. And that brings you into the bondage of debt. That has become so pervasive in society by changes in society that we're not even consciously aware of it. You know, that while you have to borrow money to buy a home, you could never pay for a home cash. I mean, that's just impossible. Well, it wasn't impossible 100 years ago. People actually did it 100 years ago. The idea of a 3-year mortgage was just foreign to many people back in 1910, 1920. They got homes without paying for even 3 years. Then all of a sudden it went up to a 5-year mortgage. 5 years to pay off your house? That's amazing, people would say. But that's actually the progression of things. Then there was the, you know, 20-year mortgage, 10-year mortgage. I had a 10-year mortgage once. You know, it was $160 a month. Actually, it was $160.01, and it included the prorated property tax and insurance on a duplex in a nice neighborhood. So, 3 bedrooms, was it 3 bedrooms upstairs, 2 bedrooms down? And, you know, that's what it was. That was 10 years, and that was hard for me to even accept that idea. We only had that loan for 6 months, and then we got out of debt and have never been in debt since. But today, for the average American, they can't imagine not having a 20-year or 30-year mortgage. And then now they have mortgages that you don't even pay off the principal. They're lifetime mortgages. You will always pay the mortgage. Forever and ever and ever, you will pay the mortgage. And they sign these things. It's just amazing. So, but the fact that they get to the point where they do that has been a process of change in your thinking. By changing certain elements of society, by changing certain criteria of society, certain moral criteria of society, you say suddenly, that's okay. You know, at one time it was not okay. And I have given the example of the definition of democracy in the military manual in 1927. Democracy was a bad thing. It was an evil form of government. It was in the U.S. military manual explained that democracy was a bad thing. But by 1945, democracy became a good thing. I don't know that anybody voted and said, well, from now on, we're going to say democracy is a good thing. They just introduced a change in society. During war, it's always easier to do because people are preoccupied with the war. And they began to teach in the schools that democracy was a good thing. It was a good form of government. Never mind the fact that the early so-called forefathers of America often preached against democracy as a bad form of government, a dangerous form of government, a self-destructive form of government. But now if I tell you that today, you're going to think, well, that's crazy because that goes against what I've been taught. So I had to write a whole book explaining and showing people that this is the way people thought of democracy at this time, and this is the way the people thought of democracy today. And something changed. We were taught something different. Then you can go back in history and find out what happened to democracies, because they all failed. And that was common knowledge for people who studied history 100 years ago. But if you study history today in American schools, you won't learn that, because they've changed the way you think. And of course, repentance is to change the way you think, is to go think another way. It's a turning around of your mind and thinking another way. Democracies lend themselves to the idea that it's okay to covet your neighbor's goods, to vote in benefits for yourself at the expense of your neighbor. And there are people who are actually seeking self-reliance while at the same time trying to vote in a socialist agenda in their government, even, you know, for their welfare, you know, because they know we should take care of the elderly and the weak and the poor and all this stuff. And somehow or other, they think that's the government's job. Every job you assign to the government, it must be a job that you had originally and now have decided that the government should be responsible for that job. And when you did that, you abandon a responsibility. And when you abandon a responsibility, you abandon a right, because rights and responsibilities are correlative. They go hand in hand. You cannot deny one without denying the other. So in self-reliance, to really be self-reliant, one must take back their responsibilities. And that's what you see in these different groups where they're, or individuals, they're actually not really that many groups, although some of them have like, you know, like 25,000 followers in their blog, which is a huge number of people. And of course, they're getting, you know, an email newsletter and a blog. They may read it, they may not read it, they may never ever read it, and they may not even exist anymore. They had an email and they've lost the email. These 25,000 people, they're not necessarily putting anything in. They're getting this free newsletter. You just sign up for it. But their information is going out, and they're talking about lots of different things. And I've made a note on some of them. Like I say, they talk about the permaculture revolution. They talk about, like Lori Neverman talks about, backyard to desert to degraded Midwestern farmlands, permaculture is revolutionizing food production. Learn how you can develop a healthy, productive ecosystem that heals the soil while producing a diversity of foods. And, you know, she has a common sense home.com website, and she talks about everything from, you know, homesteading to preparedness, etc. There's other people that they interviewed, but one of the words that I looked at, you know, that I always find interesting to look at the origin of words. You talk about ecosystem or ecology. What is that ecology? Where does that come from? Obviously, logi has to do with studying. Logos, word. Ology, whenever you see ology on there, it's some sort of study. It's the words about a particular thing, and the thing that it's about is the first syllable. And in this case, it's echo, which actually comes from okimonos, which is the word in Greek for house. So ecology is the study of your house? Well, it's the study of where you live. Okinomos is, you know, where you live is this whole environment around you, which may be in the house if you're in the house. It may be out in the yard if you're out in the yard, I guess. But it's the interaction of all these things, just like your roof exists because your walls are there. Your roof is dependent upon your walls supporting it. And it's the same way if you're going to have a garden, the dirt is part of that support of your garden. So what about the ecology of society? You know, we talk about the ecology of nature, but society is within nature. It exists within nature. And of course, our topic is not just permaculture, but perma-community. It's the perma-community, which is us, a part of that oikonomos, that house, that ecology, and what part we play in it. And like I was saying, that some of the people like Dr. Kusin, you know, who talks about it, Dr. Kusin in the Tree of Life and all this kind of stuff, and he talks about the planet, that we're one with the planet. He talks about the seen teachings. We talk about the seen teachings. He also talks about Native Americans as if they understood these things and all this stuff. And like I was saying in an earlier show, the Europeans at one time understood the importance of nature and cooperation with nature. One of the things that the Romans, at the time of the rise of the Roman Empire, when they went to Great Britain and saw how the Brits were farming, they made a huge study of it, because they said, these people know about nature. They know about companion planting. They know about how to grow crops, how to preserve food, how to preserve grain, and they have lots of skills. The Romans actually used to have, but lost as they became this citified society, where the cessation of growing of grain in Italy was a real problem, because they didn't need to grow grain in Italy, because they had so much trade between Rome and Egypt. And they had these huge giant ships that would go and fill up with thousands and thousands of bushels of grain and bring them to, you know, either as tribute or in payment for other things that the Romans did, because the Romans had this huge amount of money that was coming in that these other, and then they would go out and invest in places like Egypt, building harbors and roads and everything, and then Egypt would owe them money back, and they would pay off their national debt with grain. And so they had this huge amount of grain coming in, which kept the price of grain down, which all the people applauded, but it ran the grain farmers out of business. And we see the same thing going on in America with businesses going overseas, and businesses in America can't compete. And we say, why can't we compete? Well, the major reason is the banking system. And we've been operating on our laurels. So we've created this entirely interdependent economy where you're dependent upon, you know, foreign sources of all kinds of things. You know, we don't even make a shirt hardly in America. You know, we don't weave cloth in America. Most of the looms are all out of business. Our shoes are being made overseas. We don't make these things at home. And that's going to be a problem someday if we can't get them from abroad. You know, it takes $1 million factory to make a shirt, make a pair of pants, to weave the cloth. We don't know how to do that. But that total dependence of society upon other people manufacturing things that you need, people, for some strange reason, wake up in the morning and want to be less dependent upon that system, which, you know, they put names on it like the Matrix, etc., etc. So how do we do that? How do we get independent of that? And, of course, these different people like Marion Hennine, who talks about the bees, and Brad DeRosia, who talks about family homestead and some of the things that he's learned, Marjorie Wildcrive, Paul Wheaton, who is, you know, really coined the word, I guess, permaculture. I believe that was Paul who did that. And some of these other people, Mike Adams, who's big into health and also now big into growing food, and these little closed ecologies actually within your home almost, so that you grow it all that you need that way and you get better food, because he's saying the food that you're buying in the stores have less nutrition than the food that the poor people ate 100 years ago. And of course we do have, you know, all sorts of chronic diseases showing up left and right all over society, immune diseases, autoimmune diseases, destroying the health of society. If you look back and you're kind of a health forensic nut, where you're measuring the amount of sicknesses and illnesses and disease, that we have more sick people today than we had before. And the real guys who should receive the award for improving the health of society is not doctors, but plumbers. Plumbers did more to improving the health of society by removing the waste of society in a healthy way so that we weren't contaminating ourselves with our own excrement. Because that's where you got parasites and everything. That's all coming back now. Even with the great plumbing, we're now bringing back a lot of the problems, and we don't see it. Some people are seeing it, and they're trying to do something about it, growing their own food, becoming that self-reliant. But ultimately, it's not just permaculture, you and your house. If you're going to look at nature, you got to look at all of nature. The seasons, the altitudes, the temperatures, the moisture, if you're going to grow a garden, the fertility, the soil is alive with thousands of different kinds of bacteria interacting. And if that health of the soil is not there, the health of your plant will not be there because they're all interconnected. That's what you learn from permaculture. But permaculture doesn't, even though it's a coin phrase referring to your garden and farming methods, the fact is culture, you are a part of a culture. In your culture today, it's okay to take from your neighbor so you can have free education or free health care or free this, that, and the other thing. That's become a part of the American culture. It didn't used to be a part of the American culture. And so the American culture, which when they were self-sustaining, they took care of one another, everybody was better educated, they knew more about the world, they all knew how to read and write, they had extensive resources, and now we could have even more with all the things that we've invented. But the reality is that people don't even know where Mount Rushmore is. They don't know who won the Civil War. They don't know all kinds of things. They don't know where their food comes. They actually think GMOs are good. That GMOs are a good thing because they heard that somewhere. Somebody told them that. You know, they read it on the internet. But the reality is it's one of the most dangerous things that has come along in this last century. And it will lead eventually to the death and starvation of millions upon millions of people. And there's a number of reasons why, not just because GMOs are around, but because of elements of society have completely disappeared. Elements of the farming community have completely disappeared because of the introduction of GMOs, which actually involves pickups and trailers. A whole industry that thrived in the Midwest. Hundreds and hundreds of people depended upon that for their livelihood. And it was seed cleaning. Seed cleaners were everywhere throughout the Midwest. They would, everything from big semis to little pickups, they would go around. And of course, there were stationary ones. Now we have one out in Christmas Valley. They clean seeds, certain seeds. And it's a whole industry. Except for now, it's almost, the traveling seed cleaners are almost gone. Many of the stationary seed cleaners are gone. They don't do it anymore. Why? Because they've been run out of business by Monsanto. Now, you would think that has nothing to do with what I put in my mouth or anything. They get seeds from somewhere else, but the private seed cleaners are all out of business. Well, how would that affect me, you think? Well, see, that's one of the things in the kingdom of God. You have to care about your neighbor as much as you care about yourself. And because nobody cared that these guys were running out of business, it was very easy to run them out of business just by bringing court cases against them that they might have cleaned some GMO seeds, which guys had patents on. And if you did that, you committed a crime. And so they were run out of business because they couldn't handle the lawsuits. Well, what does that mean to you? Well, it means the Ukrainian famine that took place after World War II and through this whole process of the takeover. No, it wasn't just after World War II, but the whole process of the rise of the Soviet Union and Stalin and took place because the seed grain disappeared from the farmers. The major farmers that supplied the breadbasket of Russia didn't have seed grain. They didn't have anything to plant. It was gone. They had no way to get seed to plant. And so they didn't plant. And they starved. And mothers decided which of their children would live and which children would die, and gave up their own life. You know, people were just emaciated with starvation because there was no seeds to plant. You live in the city, you say, well, I just go to the store and get food. But they don't see the process. They don't see how things are connected. Well, if there's not seeds to plant in the Midwest of the United States, America will starve by the millions. And Europe sees this. They understand this. But Americans aren't seeing this. And this is tragic. And because you don't hear it on 6 o'clock news, you think it's not the case. But now we have these people going out and trying to create this, you know, this sustainable agriculture, permaculture, self-reliance. But they need a self-reliance in a bigger way. And that's what we're going to talk when we get back. Okay, welcome back. So how do you become self-reliant? Well, you can't. I've homesteaded. I've, you know, grown our own food. I've done all that stuff for years. And the fact is you often need other people. You need a community. Sure, you can find somebody who's going to go up in the wilderness and he's going to survive up there and he's going to hunt bear and eat that and all that stuff. And such individuals exist, but they don't usually exist as families. You know, even the Swiss family of Robinson, when they were Crusoed on the island in the novel of the Robinson family, they eventually had to have other people come in. The boys had to marry somebody in order to produce the next generation, and that. Societies are born in the family. So families don't continue to recreate themselves. They need other families interacting with them. And so that's community. And the fact is you can't produce everything you need all the time. Occasionally you will need other help. And then there's the great danger of the fact that other marauding bands may come around and put an end to you. So you want allies, other people to be there. And of course we see with people like Abraham, he had all kinds of allies who joined him in defeating these kings who came in and defeated Sodom and Gomorrah and other city-states. And where did they come from and why did they appear? And most people have no idea how that works. So when people talk about their perma community or their communities that continue and they talk about the individual being at peace with the community, not at war with the community, not at odds with the community, being at peace with the nature. Like Cousin talks about peace with animals, you become a vegetarian. You don't need to become a vegetarian to reap the health of a vegetarian diet. I was just talking to somebody last night and pointing out if people actually studied the history of things in detail so that they actually know that the pieces fit together. You know, like I was mentioning earlier in the show, the 1871 Act that they said incorporated the United States. Well, when you read their scenario of things, it sounds logical what they're doing. But if you are missing pieces of the puzzle, you will be fooled by their rationale. But the main reason you're fooled by their rationale about the United States becoming a corporation suddenly in 1871 because Congress decided to make it so, the reason it succeeds is not because it is a rational argument. because you can show that it's not a rational argument if you get more facts. But the reason it succeeds is because people want to blame somebody else. They want to think it's somebody else's fault. Well, the same characteristic in you that wants to think that it's somebody else's fault, it's not my fault, also holds up other people as saints and say that these are our saints, these are our good people, these are our heroes. And of course, that's what Jesus is to people. He's a hero, and they hold up Jesus. But they're not holding up the whole Jesus. They only hold up part of it. And I see the same thing with people who hold up the Native American. They said, well, the Native American were in harmony with nature. Well, to some degree, their culture was in harmony with nature. Every farmer, to some degree, is in harmony with nature, and to some degree, he's not. And the fact is that before the Five Nations came together with the, you know, the great pine tree of peace concept all written out in wampum that united five major tribes and eventually seven major tribes and swallowed up many other minor tribes, they had a problem with cannibalism in America. They had a problem with the shortage of game in America. We always think, you know, America was thriving with this game everywhere, and food everywhere. You can just go hunting and fishing all the time. Well, the fact is there were so many people on the coastline. You know, the early ships that came over here that sailed down the coastline said that they couldn't find an inlet, that a hail of arrows didn't come at the ship when they came into these inlets, because there were fires all along the coast for miles and miles and miles and miles. They would see campfires because there were so many Indians. They were everywhere. So many of the inhabitants, they were everywhere. Yeah, and they were hunter-gatherers. Well, because there were so many, that hunting and gathering became competitive. And there were wars over territory. Oh, nobody can own the land, supposedly all the Indians know. But the reality is that they were very territorial. They were constantly having wars between themselves. Even when their numbers were decreased by disease, they were still worried extremely about other larger tribes taking them over. And we see even Lewis and Clark traveling across when they came upon the, I believe it was the Cheyenne, or I can't remember which tribe it was. They had been decimated by raids from the Blackfoot. That was a real problem. They were constantly attacking one another. There were some whole tribes that they made their entire living by robbing other tribes. They didn't produce very much themselves. They mostly stole from other tribes. And, of course, they did do hunting and fishing as well, but they were notorious thieves in some tribes. And the fact is, you would find good people, you know, you'd find good pinderels and bad traitorous pinderels and nespers. You would find good and you would find bad and all the different, just the same as you would find in Europeans. That, you know, to even say the Indians understood is a racist statement. To say that Indians understood and other races did not understand is crazy. It's a terribly racist statement. Some Indians understood. Some Indians were not only in harmony with nature, but they were in harmony with righteousness. And some were not. Some were evil. Some were murderous. Some were treacherous. Same as you found amongst Europeans. I don't believe that there was any. The truth is manifest destiny, which supposedly is what wiped out the Indians, which is supposedly an idea of the Europeans that came over here. Manifest destiny, that wherever we go, we will dominate that area. The reality is that was a major part of the interpretation of the Pine Tree of Peace, the Constitution of the Iroquois, whatever you want to call it. is that when a nation would not sit down with their way of bringing the nations together, that you had the right to swallow up that nation, suppress that nation, oppress that nation, subjugate that nation, and give it no seat at the council. Now, that may not have been the original intent of the individuals who put together this constitution, but it was certainly the interpretation by many of the tribes, especially the bigger tribes. And the tribes that allied themselves with the pilgrims, and that's a big long story, but the ones that did so because they feared bigger tribes conquering them, and they wanted the pilgrims as their allies. The pilgrims did have things like cannons, and they did have these big ships, and they did have trade goods. And so they wanted to ally themselves with them because they feared being overrun by Native Americans, other Native Americans, who would conquer them, steal their women, kill them, take over their territory. So where's the harmony in that? The reality is we have to be careful about ennobilizing whole races or groups of people. They had their good, they had their bad. The same as, should we all be vegetarians and that would make us at peace with animals? A shepherd has a symbiotic relationship with his flock. You know, we were just shearing the sheep recently. If you don't shear the sheep, they die. You have to shear the sheep. It's not like shearing your flock in church. That's the big story, is that you supposedly put your hand on the sheep and they just lay there and let you shear them. There's lots of people who do sermons with that idea, and that's true. I told somebody who brought that up, and I said, well, that's sort of true. This is some of the sheep, you have to lay your hand on them a little harder than with others. One of the most domesticated sheep in the whole flock will come up to you and will actually want you to pet them. Most of the sheep don't do that. But this sheep will actually walk out of the herd and come up to you. I don't know if it was a bummer for part of the time or what when it was younger. But when it came through the chute and the shearer started to shear it, it fought the worst. I mean, it actually was kicking and making a real commotion. And I says, that's amazing. That's the tamest sheep in the flock. And they said, that's always the way it is. The tamest sheep in the flock, the most domesticated sheep, is the one that fights us when we shear them. But anyway, the point is that we talked about political pundits like Bernie Sanders. And I says, well, Bernie has the same policy with people as I have with my flock, is that I provide them with free hay and free graze and free water and all these free things, and then I eat their young. which is really, they all got a chuckle out of that, because and we don't just eat their young, but we sell off some of the flock to feed other people, feed our neighbors, feed other people around the country. We shear them and turn the wool into clothing. But we keep the life of the whole herd, because the herd moves as one. And without us, without the shepherd, the sheep would die. They have to be sheared or they will die in a few years, because the wool will grow too great. They have to be protected from coyotes. You have to put up hay for them to survive through the winter. And if you provide the best hay for them when they're lambing, then their lambs will do better. We pour out our lives so that those sheep will survive. And what do those sheep do? They go out on the desert and turn grasses that would turn gray and wolfy and just die and disintegrate and actually stop growing, because they become bunch grass. They get too thick. They never get grazed off. That's bad for grass. Grass is designed to be grazed off. So we take that grass that gets grazed from time to time, and we turn it into nutrition. We turn it into wool for clothing. And we pour out our life to sustain the flock, and the flock pours out some of its life to sustain us. That's a symbiotic relationship. That's nature. Eating meat is okay. You shouldn't eat meat every day, 365 days out of the year. Your body isn't designed to do that for the most part. Should be periods of time where you fast from meat. Because there are enzymes in the body, part of your immune system, that actually will destroy cancers, but it also is used to digest meat when the meat enters into your bloodstream. It's part of that system. So if you eat meat every day, they never get a chance. Those same enzymes won't get a chance to go and fight cancers in your body that develop. So, yeah, if you eat meat every day, we saw a rise in cancer as soon as the American population started doing that. Because the introduction of refrigeration and the improvement in the economy, seemingly improvement in the economy by the existence of ready cash, which was through the Federal Reserve. So it stimulated the economy. People were able to eat meat every day. Refrigeration and transportation of meat, all this stuff led to a change in our diet, which brought about more cancer. And so these are elements of society that make society unhealthy. There are millions of these elements. You can't even probably memorize them all. But when you start understanding certain basic principles that Christ taught, that Moses taught, that Abraham taught, then all these things start falling into place. And like this Kusin, who just talks about this, you know, he talks about the Native American and being in harmony. What is that harmony? You know, or being at peace with animals, being at peace with the plants, being at peace with the culture, being at peace with the ecology. And again, what is ecology? Eco, from okamene, house, ology, study, the study of the house. We live in the world. That's the house we live in. Are we at peace with that house? We were to live in the world, but not of the world. We would, you know, supposed to be running with stranger to make peace with them. Christ is talking about this. But how do we apply that to everyday life? Are we in harmony? Are we in harmony with each other? What we really want to be in harmony with is righteousness. And what is righteousness? We have to care about our neighbor as much as we care about ourselves. That's what brings you in peace, you know, into a state of peace with the world around you. Forgiveness is the end of conflict. If forgiving becomes a part of your nature, then you will be at peace with the world around you, with the people around you, with the cultures around you. And that forgiveness is important in seeking the harmony with righteousness. Because you're not judge, somebody else is judge. So how does this play out in everyday communities? How does this play out? And of course, we take you back to the design that Christ was giving. Christ was telling the people to love one another as I have loved you. How did he love us? He sacrificed himself. He gave up his time, his energy, his wealth. It says, though he was rich, he made himself poor. Common misunderstanding. Jesus was actually from one of the richest families in Judea. He wasn't a poor carpenter. People made that up. The Bible says he was a carpenter. Joseph was a carpenter. He probably wasn't even a carpenter. Actually, what he's saying is that he was a builder. And in those days, they did build out of wood, but mostly they built out of stone. So he was probably a stonemason, especially if he went to Egypt, because they built with stone. And we know that relatives of Jesus were extremely wealthy. And in those days, families shared their wealth with their family. If you wanted a loan, you went to somebody in your family. You didn't go to a bank. But it says that though he was rich, he made himself poor. He gave up his wealth to become this preacher of this other way of existing. What Jesus was doing was creating an intentional community. A community that would continue, would not die. This worm will not die. We can kill it if we stray from the formula that Christ gave us. And what was part of that formula? When they said, what must we do to obtain eternal life? In other words, what must we do to have a perma community? A permanent community. Because they're not just talking about themselves. They're talking about their people. What must they do? He says, thou knowest the commandments, keep them. So these commandments, these Ten Commandments, were a secret to a perma-intentional community. You couldn't be stealing from one another. You couldn't be bearing false witness to one another. You couldn't be coveting one another's goods. That was an essential element. Now, if you take one of the commandments and break them as a matter of policy, you break all the commandments as a matter of policy. So if you suddenly accept in your mind, in your church, that it's okay to apply to men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority to obtain benefits at the expense of your neighbor, if you think that's okay, you have denied Christ. You have denied the way of Christ. The perfect law of liberty doesn't exist for you anymore. Your perfect law is take from my neighbor so that I can have more. So, you know, how do we remedy that? How do we change that? We have to change our thinking. We have to realize that it's not bad. Somebody just talked on the internet about the fact that their grandchild had a $200,000 debt, a medical debt, because they had to have this operation. We had somebody who was injured on the network. I don't know how much all the bills came to. I know they probably came to well over $100,000. If you added them all up at face value, I'm sure they were over $100,000, probably closer to $200,000 than to $100,000. I don't know. We have people who would know, but I just don't know my own mind, but I know it was high. I also know that through the church and through some of the things that we share with people and show them how these things work, they were able to negotiate those bills down to a fraction of what they were. And because they were a part of a congregation of record, at least some members of the congregation of record, even though it's not a very big congregation, it's a tiny, tiny little congregation, even by our standards, they were able to pay thousands and thousands of dollars in those medical bills for them. And these people, the interesting thing is those people whose bills that were getting paid, they were working hard people. Of course, they had this injury that required this medical expense, so that hampered their ability to work. But then people actually showed up to help them maintain their business. They could actually be completely on government dole. They qualify for being completely on government dole, not even for this injury, but for previous difficulties. They reject the government dole. They refuse to take the money from the government because they know, deep down, they know that if you take money from the government, you're actually taking from your neighbor. And they don't want to covet their neighbor's goods. Now, a lot of people want them to do that, but they're not doing that. Instead, they're trying to pay the bill off themselves. And, of course, they go and negotiate the bill, and it's reduced. And the church calls up, and the church is going to pay a bill that's, you know, over $1,000. And they said, well, no, just pay $90. Wow. You know, they saved saved over $1,000 on that bill. On that one bill alone. Because the church, which is not me, but the congregations, I mean, I don't have the money. Me personally, I've offered to help out in many ways, and we have helped out and with different people throughout the network. But the reality is the congregation is seeing that these bills are getting paid, and they have a payment plan. And if they had real, you know, 10 family congregation who was giving like Christ said to give, and that congregation was linked with another 10 congregations or another 9 congregations, and they were all giving, We could have gone in and negotiated that bill down to a fraction overnight. Say, hey, we've got, you know, you got a $200,000 bill. We'll pay it right now for how much. You'd be surprised how much they would take. Maybe $30,000, maybe less, if you pay it cash right up front. But besides that, the fact is there are alternatives to many of the expensive cures offered by modern medicine. You know, in the series, The Truth About Cancer, there are many, many people that are finding things that cure them, complete remission without the chemo, without all the side effects, and good health besides. Amazing stories. But anyway, we'll have to continue this next time on Keys to the Kingdom. Until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.